Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, March the 6th. The U.S. House of Representatives passed the Employee Free Choice Act last Thursday, a bill that has been pushed for some time by organized labor but didn't get very far in a Republican-controlled Congress of past. That changed, and last week the House and the bill, which gives workers the right to decide how to form a union, whether it be by signing union cards or by holding elections, passed in the House. Should the Senate pass this bill too? Should the president sign it? The president has already threatened a veto. We will talk about the act and other issues before Congress affecting labor and working people with David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm good. Are you celebrating a bit these days?
Well, kind of half celebrating, since actually getting legislation passed and implemented is a three-step process. You have to pass the House, the Senate, and then get the president to sign something.
Right.
And we're through step one out of that process.
Yeah, the House
got a ways to go.
Yeah, in fact, the New York Times today editorialized that that this should pass the Senate and the president should sign it. The New York Times is on your side.
Well, that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that in the Senate, given their rules, you need 60 votes, not just a majority, in order to prevent a filibuster. And it's very difficult to get 60 votes in the Senate these days.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that I'm not sure if the president has said this, but Vice President Dick Cheney has said that if the bill gets on President Bush's desk, he will veto it.
Oh, it was the Vice President that made the threat. Okay. Tell me, how significant is this Employee Free Choice Act that did pass in the House? How significant is it?
Well, actually, it's very significant. And even if we cannot get it passed and signed this session, simply getting it passed in the House is a major step forward. And let's kind of put this in a larger context, because I think most people would admit that it's the union movement that built the middle class in this country. And yet, it's the middle class, it's working people who have been under an immense assault in terms of their living standards over the last 25 years especially. And when you go back and look at the history of what working people have been going through, you see that from the end of the Second World War until the early 1970s, working people were actually making very real gains. And they were making gains that were basically parallel to the increases in their own productivity, in other words, how much they were producing per hour. From the early 1970s on, that connection disappeared. Productivity continued to rise at a very rapid rate, and yet working people did not benefit from that increased productivity. So that today, the actual wages in terms of the value of what their paychecks will buy, the average wage, the real wage of working people, has not changed much at all in the last 25 years. And a lot of this is due to the fact that the percentage of people who in the workforce who are union has gone down every year since that time. Not that we have lost members. The actual number of union members has stayed pretty much steady, but the problem is that the workforce itself has increased while the number of union members has been static, and as a result, the percentage has gone down.
Yeah, so how would this Employee Free Choice Act make it easier to unionize?
Well, okay, getting to the actual specifics of the bill. We have a very, very weak system of labor law in the United States. In fact, it's the weakest system within the industrialized world in terms of protecting the right of workers to organize. And the way the law works is that 30% of workers at any particular enterprise need to sign cards saying they want to be represented by a union. Once they have 30%, they can go to the National Labor Relations Board and ask for an election. Now, while that is the usual path to actually gaining a union, it's not the only one, because if a majority of workers sign cards saying that they want a union, they have the right to go to the employer and say, okay, you know, we're a majority, we want X union to represent us. But the problem is that the employer then has the right to say, well, that's nice, let's go to a protracted election process and we'll find out through a quote-unquote secret ballot process if that's the case. In that interim period, increasingly what we have found is that employers are harassing and intimidating workers to vote against joining the union, against having a union represent them. And this has become actually a billion-dollar industry. And anti-union consultants have become extremely adept and skilled at intimidating workers. In actually 25% of these situations where workers have said they want a union, at least one worker, one union supporter, is fired illegally in order to essentially send the message that if you vote for the union, this is what's going to happen to you. And there are certainly a number of other instances we can talk about later.
Yeah. In fact, I need to check our weather forecast before we continue our discussion about this Employee Free Choice Act that passed in the House of Representatives last week, talking with David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. 1-800-642-1234. Our toll-free number if you would like to join in the conversation with a question or a thought about this. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, March the 6th. Hoping you'll join Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6. It's At Issue with Ben Marins. And after 5 o'clock, Ben will talk with a guest about a new trend that people are noticing. Retirees who have settled in Florida and Arizona moving back to Wisconsin and other parts of the Midwest. More talk about this boomerang migration coming up after 5 this afternoon. We're talking with David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, talking about a bill that recently, last week, passed in the U.S. House of Representatives that would make it easier for workers to unionize. But its fate remains unclear in the Senate, and reportedly President Bush would veto this bill should it reach his desk. We're talking about this bill and other legislation before Congress that organized labor would like to see pass, and welcoming your thoughts and questions for David Newby. And our lines are already full, David Newby, but let me ask you, why shouldn't employers retain this power that they currently have to insist on an election to unionize workers?
Well, first of all, the right to have a union in the workplace ought to be the exclusive right of employees themselves without the intervention of management. And yet we have developed a system and an expectation that this is going to be an election campaign in which management has all the advantages to intimidate and harass workers against forming and joining a union, and the union itself is on the defensive. That was not always the case. Up until the Taft-Hartley bill was passed in the late 1940s, it was the usual pattern that workers would simply sign a majority of cards saying we want a union. That would be checked and certified, and people would have a union. It's still the dominant form, for example, in Canada, where you have what is called a card check process. It's simply a signing up process of majority of workers saying that they want a union. So we've gotten away from the democratic right of workers themselves having the power to say that they want a union to a situation in which really management has the upper hand. They have much more control over the process itself. So what this Employee Free Choice Act does is essentially restore a democratic process in which workers, if they want a union, can have it, and they're also guaranteed that when they get to the bargaining table, that if the employer is recalcitrant and not willing to actually bargain fairly with the workers, that there will be an arbitrated first contract.
Yeah. So I promised callers I won't take too much more time, but why in the world would the president reportedly veto this legislation that would say, okay, workers, if you all sign these cards and say you all want a union, you can have a union?
Well, because the current administration and our current president is not particularly worker-friendly, and the current law and our current process gives management an advantage. It keeps the union movement weak. It makes it difficult for workers to organize. And that's exactly the way corporations want to see it stay.
All right. Joe in La Crosse is with us. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Thank you, Joy. It's been a while since I've had a chance to call in, and I appreciate the opportunity this morning. I think your guest should be on a Food Network show because he's provided a recipe for continuing the us versus them theory of management and labor. And unfortunately, I'm finding myself in a position of defending the administration that I don't like to be in, and I agree that President Bush should veto this bill. And actually, the intimidation he speaks of frequently takes place on the labor side much more prevalently than on the management side.
Yeah, what do you mean?
What they've documented over the years is that when a union wants to come in, the intimidation tactics, although don't get me wrong, certainly management has always been guilty of such things, is that the unions actually tend to be the people intimidating the workers. And when they do counts of cards versus the actual balloting, when there's a secret ballot, what they find is that there's a smaller number of people that vote in favor of it who have made public statements who are trying to avoid having to deal with retribution from the union.
Yeah. All right, let David Newby, what about that?
Well, the actual research indicates that that is not the case, that the intimidation is coming from the management side. As I indicated, in about one out of four situations where workers are trying to organize in the private sector, at least one person is fired simply for favoring the right to organize a union. In almost every situation, the figure is about 92%, if you want the actual figure. Employers force employees to attend mandatory closed-door meetings in which they will urge union or urge their workers not to vote in favor of the union. And this is not a situation in which we have a democratic free election, because the union does not have the right to get information to workers in the workplace. That right is reserved solely to management. The union has to talk to people entirely in non-work times. The employer has the right to force people to attend meetings in which they put out anti-union propaganda. They have the right to have one-on-one meetings between supervisors and workers in which they can intimidate workers. And again, without any right for workers to have any representation themselves, so it's not like a regular election in which we go to the polls in April or November to elect our own representatives, because in this situation it's one side that has all the advantages.
Yeah, Joe, I'm glad you called. I'd bring you back for a follow up, but your cell phone is kind of hard to. It's got a bad line, so I'm going to move on to David in Fort Atkinson. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I am a conservative, Republican leaning, upper middle class information technology professional, and I would say that I am absolutely 100% in favor of this legislation. We have seen for years the power center in the management labor relations shift continually toward management. We have seen headline after headline of downsizing, outsourcing, offshoring. American corporations have defaulted at increasing rates on pensions for workers. They are slashing their benefits packages for health care and other things. And we have seen also repeated headlines and news stories about the incredible golden parachute employment agreements that upper management has. And it's just time that American workers wake up and realize that the us versus them situation that the prior caller mentioned has been perpetuated by management, and that the American worker is under assault in so many ways. And the only way to redress this is to have legislation like this passed. I would say, though, also to your guest, that one of the reasons that the labor movement has fallen into such disrepute is that labor leaders in the 70s engaged in a lot of the same practices that management engaged in. And I would say that I would encourage your guest to also support a right-to-work kind of environment where employees are not forced to join a labor union.
David Newby?
You know, except for the last comment, I would totally agree. In fact, I was going to say, let's turn over the show to the caller. And, you know, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but, you know, right-to-work legislation, which was passed as part of the Taft-Hartley bill in the late 1940s, essentially says that in most situations, if workers who are in a union environment where workers have said, yes, they want to be represented by a union, they can say that, no, they don't want to participate, and they don't want to particularly participate in the costs of representation, because, you know, having a voice at work, being able to file grievances and bargain a contract, unfortunately takes resources. And the so-called right-to-work legislation allows people to opt out of paying their fair share. So with that one exception, I would absolutely agree with the caller. And it's interesting that he is coming from an environment, I don't know his particular work situation, but being an information technology, computer specialist, he's coming from sort of the cutting edge of where our economy is, the type of profession where people generally assume that they don't need a union, and yet the caller recognizes that really the scales have been tipped, and that working people, no matter what kind of work they do, actually need a voice at work and to have that protected.
Yeah. We only have a minute before news time, but I wanted to just get your comments on. He brought up the CEO pay and the golden parachutes that they have when they leave their companies. Do you support the legislation in Congress that would give shareholders of a company say over any kind of retirement package for CEOs?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and why?
Well, currently there seems to be no check whatsoever on what the top corporate executive can rip off from the corporation and shareholders and the workers. And what we need is a situation where there is more democratic control over the economy, in which wages and salaries and perks and everything else for top management is under some control, so that we have an economy in which there is a reasonable and a fair distribution of the value that is created by workers, how that can be shared.
We are talking with David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, about legislation in Congress involving workers and labor. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 on this Tuesday, March the 6th. We're talking this hour with David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. He's talking with us about legislation that passed in the U.S. House of Representatives last week, the Employee Choice Act. Where is it? Anyway, talking about this legislation that would make it easier for workers to unionize. This bill now goes to the Senate to take it up, but President Bush reportedly has promised to veto this legislation should it reach his desk. Apparently, this bill that would make it easier to form a union, the Employee Free Choice Act, would allow workers to sign union cards and make that the way of forming a union and take away the power of companies to insist on an election to form a union. We're talking about this act and other legislation before Congress dealing with labor and workers. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890 if you'd like to join in with a question for our guest. Victor in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joey. Good morning to your guests.
Good morning. Two questions.
One is illegal aliens and legal residents. How does legislation affect them? Because, you know, there's definite language barrier, and a lot of them are probably concerned or maybe intimidated that, hey, I went through all these legal hassles or legal hassles to get these jobs. All of a sudden, I decide I want to unionize. I might get kicked out or fired or all kinds of things. So how would this legislation reach out to those people who don't speak, you know, English, and they could be full citizens?
Well, unfortunately, the legislation itself does not speak directly to that situation. But you're very right that employers use the threat of calling in the Immigration Service in order to essentially deport any worker that does not have the proper papers and use that as a means of intimidation against workers actually forming a union. So that's one more of the very common tactics that's used by management. And what we really, the actual fact of the matter is that under labor law, and this is one of the good things about American labor law, it does not make that distinction. It says that workers have rights because they're workers, whether it has to do with health and safety or whether it has the right, whether it relates to the right to join a union. But once again, the employer, in a situation in which there is a protracted campaign between the union and management, that's a tactic that is often used against workers who may well be citizens and yet have the feeling that they are at risk because they are immigrants and are not, therefore, assumed to have the same rights as anybody else in this country.
Yeah, thanks, Victor. We got an email from Robin in I'm not sure what city saying, you're making an assumption that all workers want a union and that all employers are ready to take advantage of their employees at every turn. Some employees don't want a union environment, which is often separatist and undermining. Some employees feel that paying union dues is a waste of money. Some employees support the efforts of their employer, are dedicated to the company, and have respect for the decisions that the employers make. I realize this isn't true of all businesses. Unions should not be formed unless workers vote on it. What's your response to that, David Newby?
Well, that's exactly what we're saying, that workers ought to have the right by a majority demonstration of interest and of what their position is without intimidation from the employer. So essentially what we're saying is that, you know, joining a union or forming a union where you work ought to be a right and not a risk. And currently it's a risk. If you try to organize a union and the employer doesn't want one in the workplace, you are at risk for being harassed, for being intimidated. And what we're saying is that it ought to be the free democratic right of workers to choose a union without intimidation from the employer.
Yeah, and you're saying by having the secret ballot and the formal election, the employer has more opportunity to intimidate the employee.
Well, it's not simply a secret ballot because, you know, signing a card and then having a neutral third party validate the fact that, you know, 50% plus one of the employees do want a union where they work, that, you know, what could be more democratic than that? The problem is the context in which supposedly secret ballot elections are currently taking place. It's the delay between the time at which workers say that they want a union and the time that the vote actually takes place. It's the advantage, the unfair advantage, that the union has to intimidate workers in that interim period that is the problem.
I wanted to ask you about another piece of legislation that's getting some news these days. The Senate has this bill that would unionize the Transportation Security Administration workers, the airport screeners.
Yes.
The administration doesn't like this bill either.
Are you surprised, Joy?
Well, So anyway, why should we unionize the TSA screeners?
You know, this is one of the most incredible things. When the Homeland Security Act was passed, it basically took away the right of workers in most of the Department of Homeland Security, took away the right for them to organize a union or even to keep a union when they had one before. And yet, and let's take the issue of the TSA workers, those who are, you know, screening our luggage, mm-hmm. unfortunately, when mm-hmm. we're trying to get on a flight a little bit late. These are the people who most need a union for two reasons. First of all, they are not being paid well. But secondly, it's in everybody's interest for these folks to have a union so that they have the protected right to speak out when something is going wrong in the system. When you don't have a union, you don't have that voice, you don't have that protection. And these are precisely the people that we want to have that protection in order for them to do their jobs effectively and to make sure that our security system is operating effectively.
We'll go now to Linda in Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, David. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I wish you luck in your endeavors. Now, I can believe President Bush would veto any bill that would have anything to do with unions because he's a Republican, and too many Republicans are tax breaks for the billionaires, and they don't have any strings attached. So they take their money and their jobs over to China, even though they're communists. But my question is, we're having a lot of immigrants coming up here from Mexico, and I don't think we'd have as many if they had a strong union down there. But I imagine the government doesn't approve of it, because I heard that the one time that they were trying to organize down there and a reporter was filming it, and right when he was filming it, he got shot and killed. And please comment.
Mm. I'm not familiar with that particular situation, but the problem in terms of immigration is a very complex one, and we need a whole show or mm-hmm. two or three or four to discuss that. But the irony is that a lot of the reasons that we have such increased immigration from Mexico is the North American Free Trade Agreement that was passed in the early 1990s. Because basically what it did was to wipe out local agriculture in Mexico and destroyed the ability of local farmers to support themselves and their families. And so what they did was to migrate north to the maquiladora factories in the northern part of Mexico, and when they couldn't find jobs there, to migrate into the United States looking for work simply in desperation of being able to support themselves and their families. So, again, it's a very complicated issue, but it's not simply the fact that it's difficult to form a union in Mexico. In fact, it might even be easier to form a union in Mexico than the United States. But once again, it is all bound up in labor policy and trade policy.
We're talking with David Newby. He's president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, talking about some bills being debated in Congress as we speak that affect organized labor and working men and women in general. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for him or want to weigh in on any of these issues. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 13 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, March the 6th. Coming up after 8 o'clock, we'll welcome in a guest who says that former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is probably the worst Secretary of Defense that this country has ever seen. We'll talk about the rise and the fall and what our guest calls the catastrophic legacy of Donald Rumsfeld coming up after 8 o'clock. We're talking about labor issues before Congress this hour with David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, focused much of the hour on this bill that passed in the U.S. House of Representatives last Thursday called the Employee Free Choice Act. This bill would give workers the right to decide how to form a union, whether it be by signing union cards or by holding elections. That power currently sits with the employer. This bill passed the House. Its fate is unclear in the Senate, and President Bush has promised to veto it. We're talking about that bill and other issues, other bills before Congress that affect labor. And our next caller is Tim in Sparta. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question and a comment. My question is, the Supreme Court recently just heard a case about union dues going to political campaigns or whatever, you know, that they all pretty much go to the Democratic Party. And I personally would have a big problem with that. I don't think the Supreme Court has come out on its ruling yet, and I was wondering if the guest has any information on that. And my comment real quick is I wanted everybody to know that's in a union does not have to have their union dues. They can take their union dues if they disagree with the political campaigns where the money is going to. They can have it go to a charitable.
Yeah, all right, we get it,
whatever,
Tim.
You know
What do you think of, and that's fine, I kind of opened up the field to talk about other things, but what do you think about this bill that passed the House? Does that make sense to you or not? To allow the workers to decide how to unionize? I guess Tim doesn't want to answer that. David Newby, you want to talk about union dues and Supreme Court cases?
Yeah, I'm not familiar. I'm not sure which or what case the caller is referring to. But he is correct that if a person in the union context does not want any of their dues money going towards political contributions, they can have that money withheld. Most union money, by the way, does not go to contributions to candidates, but simply to paying for the process of communicating with union members regarding the issues in elections and where the various candidates stand on the issues, and particularly, obviously, in relation to issues which affect them directly as workers.
Besides this Employee Free Choice Act and the bill to unionize the airport security workers, we know also that that minimum wage bill, the hike in the federal minimum wage, is likely to get through Congress this time around.
I certainly hope so. It's about time, isn't it?
Yeah. What else are you watching? What else is before Congress that maybe we don't know about or haven't talked about?
Well, let me just mention a couple things. First of all, with regard to the Employee Free Choice Act, that bill not only affects the process by which unions workers can choose a union, but it also strengthens labor law in general. Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the top of the hour that we have one of the weakest systems of labor law in the entire industrialized world, protecting the right of workers to organize. And let me just give one example of that. I had mentioned, too, that in an organizing situation, that in about one-fourth of the situations in which workers try to organize, one worker at least is fired illegally in that process. The penalty, if the employer is ultimately found guilty of doing that, and you have to go through the whole administrative law system with the National Labor Relations Board, and then the employer can appeal to the court system. So it usually takes 3 or 4 years before such a decision is reached. But if after that whole lengthy process is completed, the employer is found guilty, the penalty is that they have to give the worker the value of the wages that they would have earned had they not been fired, minus anything that they have earned in the meantime. And so, presumably, you know, in order to survive, somebody has gotten a job, and all of those wages are deducted from the penalty that the employer has to pay. What the Employee Free Choice Act does is to essentially do what we have in most other aspects of law within the United States, and that is to say that there are punitive damages. And in the case of the Employee Free Choice Act, there are treble damages for illegal activity by employers in organizing situations. You mentioned the minimum wage. The value of the minimum wage today is less than it has been for about 25 years when you're looking at the actual purchasing power of the minimum wage. The House overwhelmingly passed an increase of the minimum wage from $5.15 to $7.25 over a three-year period. Unfortunately, it's stuck in the Senate because again, giving this situation where you need 60 votes to avoid a filibuster, Republicans are saying, well, if we're going to raise the minimum wage, then we ought to give tax breaks to small employers in order to offset the impact. Here are folks that have not had a raise in over 10 years, and we're saying that their employers have to be compensated for them getting a raise, even though, obviously, inflation has taken so much out of the value of their wage. The interesting thing, too, is that in Wisconsin, about a year and a half ago, we raised our state minimum wage from $5.15 an hour up to $6.50 an hour. And so if the tax breaks go through that the Republicans are demanding and that the president is demanding, then the first year's increase would be less than, would bring us to, on the national minimum wage to less than $6.50. So employers in Wisconsin that are paying minimum wage would have the tax breaks, but they would not have to raise the wages of their own workers. I mean, the situation really is, it's laughable when you look at it, and yet it's tragic in terms of the living standards of people who are trying to get by on low-wage jobs.
All right. Thomas in Sandstone is with us now. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Talking about the union dues and political organizations and people's choices here, it's my understanding, and I'm no expert, but I think there was a case just recently, teacher in Indiana doesn't want her union dues to help promote directly or indirectly candidates who are for, you know, killing of babies, abortion. And she was told, and it's my understanding, the courts have given the unions the option to offer your money to charitable organizations for union dues and not to go to PACs or indirectly through the PACs. That's the option. It's not required. And I think that was the question that your previous caller was asking about.
Yeah, he wasn't asking about it. He was saying that every worker should know that they can tell their union to do this.
But, yeah, but they don't have to. And that's the thing. My question to the guest is, if you're for, you know, all this due process and representative things for the employees, then I would think that you would want something like this where the employee can easily pick a way not to support a political organization.
Yeah, whatever. And, David Newby?
Well, workers do have that right. But, you know, I think we also have to put this in a broader context. And the example used was the abortion issue. But, you know, unions get involved in politics not simply because they want to get involved in politics, but because the standard of living of workers is determined not only by the contracts that they can bargain, but is also affected very directly by national and state and local legislation. So our trade policy, for example, affects workers immensely in terms of whether they are able to keep their jobs, whether their companies are able to stay in business. The minimum wage that we were just talking about also is a result of legislation. So you can't, you know, the purpose of unions is to improve the standard of living and the quality of life of workers. And that affects not only those who actually are members of unions, but all workers. And some of that we can achieve through a union contract. A lot of it we can't.
Yeah.
A lot of it comes through the political process. And unless we're involved in the political process, then we're not going to be able to achieve, you know, our basic goals of improving the lives of working people.
Let me get one more call in before we're done. Dave in Menominee, hi.
Hi, thanks. I've been a factory worker since the early 80s before I became disabled, and I watched firsthand the difference between having a union, which I did not like to pay the dues, but I saw the difference from being a union employee to becoming a forced, it was called an at-will employee, and I was forced to sign a document. This is all over the place. It gives the company the will to fire you at any time for no reason, to search all your property, anything you bring onto the premises. And I was always offended by that. I watched my wage go down. I watched the rights of my rights as a worker and other workers be taken away.
Yeah.
I saw the company that the last company that I worked for would change the rules constantly. So
Dave, I'm sorry to cut you short, but we have less than a minute, David Newby, for a brief response.
Let the caller continue to talk, because, you know, here's somebody who has lived through the situation of not having any rights, and he's absolutely right that, you know, if you don't have a union, then you are an employee at will, and the employer has total dictatorial control.
And we're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Newby, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, talking with us about issues before Congress dealing with labor, including the House of Representatives on Thursday passing the Employee Free Choice Act, which would give workers the right to decide how to form a union in their workplace, whether it be by signing union cards or holding elections. That power currently sits with the corporation. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing this hour and to Karen Prager for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.